This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in London. I'm Tim Franks. We're starting the programme with the most unequivocal statement of Chinese power, Chinese manufacturing power. Beijing announced today that its trade surplus hit almost $1 trillion last year. Even adjusting for inflation, analysts say the world hasn't seen anything like this for decades and decades, probably not since the US factories ruled the globe in the wake of World War II. All this is likely to fuel those, Donald Trump foremost among them, who say that China's dominance needs to be tamed. One of the fastest growing international fashion brands is Chinese. It's Shein, a giant in what's called fast fashion. What are the ingredients of its commercial success? Well, the BBC has found that workers in Chinese factories making clothes for Shein are labouring more than 75 hours a week in contravention of the country's labour laws. These working hours aren't unusual in the southern city of Guangzhou, but the BBC's findings will add to a growing list of questions about working conditions in its factories. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker spent the day speaking to workers from dusk till dawn in the so-called Shein village to try to find out how the company makes its cut-price clothing.
We're in the beating heart of a global empire. The machines seldom stop in this factory, producing clothes for the fast fashion giant Shein. The workers listen to podcasts or cooking shows as they stitch or steam fabric. More than a dozen workers told the BBC they do this for 75 hours a week in contravention of Chinese labour laws. Most have only one day off a month. Outside, scooters rush through a warren of more than 5,000 factories, which make up the so-called Shein village in Guangzhou. At a nearby job market, workers looking for a daily paycheck examine the stitching of the kind of clothes they'd be expected to make. They get paid per piece. Their skill and speed dictate how much they make.
What do you usually make?
It depends on how difficult the item is. Something simple like a t-shirt is 1 to 2 yuan per piece, and I can make around a dozen in an hour. We earn so little. How is that enough? The cost of living is now so high.
Workers travel thousands of miles to Guangzhou to earn money to send back to their families. Shein is now one of their major employers.
I worked with Shein at their first year. I watched it grow. I think Shein will get stronger and better.
There's an almost constant supply of fabric from nearby vendors. Shein's success has been possible because this city in China has everything it needs.
We've come to the textile district of Guangzhou. It's only about 10 minutes from the actual factories. And it is bustling this lunchtime. There are dozens of workers lifting heavy rolls of fabric onto trucks, onto cars, and onto, would you believe it, scooters. Now, I have no idea how they are balancing it, but on one scooter, there's at least 7 rolls of fabric.
Later, as dinner time approaches, street vendors set up stalls selling food or even offering haircuts for workers on their dinner break. Long hours are simply a way of life, and a 75-hour week is not unusual in this industrial heartland.
Well, it's not unusual, you say, but it's clear that it's illegal and it violates basic human rights.
David Hatchfield is from the Swiss advocacy group Public Eye, which has also uncovered excessive working hours in factories producing clothes for Shein.
It's an extreme form of exploitation that happens, and this needs to be visible.
In a statement, Sheehan told the BBC that it is committed to ensuring the fair and dignified treatment of all workers within its supply chain. And Sheehan says it's investing tens of millions of dollars in strengthening governance and compliance. Sheehan also said it was striving to set the highest standards for pay. As workers head in for the last few hours of their shift, some tell us it's their duty to work hard.
This is what we Chinese need to sacrifice for our country's development.
It's just gone 10 p.m. and finally some of the factories are beginning to empty. They're filing out, jumping onto their scooters and heading home. They won't live too far away. Many of them have dormitories nearby or they live in small apartments. But I'm standing outside one factory that is still going and deliveries are still happening. It seems in this part of China, the textile capital of the world, is not a place that ever fully goes to sleep.
And that was Laura Bicker reporting from southern China. Megan Doyle is a sustainable fashion journalist. First, what does she think is behind Shein's rapid global growth?
Shein's business model is quite unique, and I think that Shein was the tipping point between fast fashion becoming ultra-fast fashion. So what Shein does is it produces quite small batches of each of its styles, and for context, while H&M might be producing something like 5,000 styles per year, in 2022, a business of fashion found that Shein was actually producing around 300,000 new styles a year. And that was, you know,
300,000 new styles a year.
And this was in 2022. So actually, that would be really conservative now, that estimate. I think it would be much higher than that. As you say, the company is growing from strength to strength. And I think ultra, ultra cheap clothing is a massive draw card for people who are concerned about how much money they're spending, but they want to buy fun new clothes all the time. And Shein has really tapped into that market of producing very cheap, very quick turnaround styles that are trending on social media, and they're able to produce them very quickly and get them out and get them into people's wardrobes.
Just in terms of, you know, why Shein, particularly now and particularly in the United Kingdom, is in the news, is that it's seeking a listing on the London Stock Exchange.
Shein doesn't actually sell clothing within China. It mainly exports its clothing to Western countries like the UK, the US and Australia. So I think it's understanding that these are key markets for it as a retailer. And if it can embed itself more into the economy through listing on the London Stock Exchange, I think that that's a fairly big draw card. But we haven't actually heard much from Shein about its intentions behind why it wants to list on the London Stock Exchange. And I think that that's part of the problem and part of the controversy is that we don't really hear much from them at all.
Well, we saw when there was senior members of Shein were up before the Business and Trade Select Committee in the House of Commons, the lower chamber of the Houses of Parliament here in London. I mean, it was a performance which drew real anger from members of Parliament about the lack of answers, it seems.
And rightfully so. I think that inquiry and that session really exposed the lack of transparency that this company is known for. There have been numerous different instances throughout the last few years where journalists or people have tried to understand more about the business model, have questioned Shein around the production, particularly pertaining to the cotton coming out of the Xinjiang region in China. It's quite unacceptable, really. I think one of the MPs said it was ridiculous and disrespectful that Shein came into that session and didn't answer any questions with any depth.
Where do you see, I guess it's difficult to generalize about consumers, but I mean, how much of a concern is it, do you think, for consumers?
You're right. It's really hard to generalize because you know, have a growing consumer base that really does care and wants to make sure that what they're purchasing isn't contributing to, you know, somebody not getting paid a fair wage or rivers being polluted with toxic chemicals. But there is also a huge, huge audience of people who really just care about the price. That's where this education element comes into it, because I think if people knew and if people understood that, you know, there are so many risks to these sort of clothing. And I think the way that you can actually get to people and make them really care about it is by understanding that, for example, you know, Shein has had lots and lots of toxic chemicals found in their clothing that are incredibly harmful. And sometimes that's the best way to get through to somebody is to say, maybe you're not so concerned about the environmental impacts or it doesn't really matter to you. But do you know that maybe if you're giving these clothes or you're buying these clothes for your children, that there might actually be some health implications there as well?
Sustainable fashion journalist Megan Doyle. Now, a familiar question. Is a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas any closer? One thing we can say for sure is that diplomatic efforts are intensifying, as is briefing and counter-briefing, talking up and talking down the chances in this, the final week of the Biden administration. Our correspondent Jonah Fisher is in Jerusalem. Jonah, one thing that is very striking are the very public divisions in the governing coalition in Israel. What can you tell us about those?
Yeah, there is an agreement which has been widely leaked in the media here from the Hamas side of these negotiations. And over the last 24 hours, we've really had the divisions within the Israeli cabinet laid bare in relation to that deal. We know that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with some of the far-right members of his cabinet, in particular the finance minister Bezalel Smotrich and the security minister Itamar Ben-Gvir last night in an attempt, it seems, to try and get them on board, or at the very least not to oppose this agreement and bring down Netanyahu's government. This morning, well, the signs are that approach hasn't been particularly effective. Mr. Smotrich posted on X, it used to be Twitter, of course, that the emerging deal would be catastrophic for Israeli national security, and continued, "Now is the time to continue at full strength to conquer and to purge the entire Gaza Strip until Hamas's complete surrender and the return of all the hostages there." Now, so an indication there of the divisions which this still draft agreement is raising within the Israeli cabinet. It has to be said that the key question will be not whether they publicly oppose it. It will be more a question of, do they go so far as to leave government if this agreement is signed off, and would they want to bring down Netanyahu's government if this deal went through? At the moment, we've just had these public statements, particularly from Mr. Smotrich.
Jonah, we'll leave it there for the time being, but thank you very much for joining us from Jerusalem. It is a story which, of course, we're covering heavily here on the BBC, keeping across, and there's a piece from one of our other Middle East correspondents, Lucy Williamson, on our BBC News website, bbc.com/news, which is headlined, "Three Things That Have Shifted Towards a Gaza Hostage Deal." We're not there yet, but there does seem to be increasing chatter in the region about perhaps its imminence. You're listening to NewsHour, live from the BBC. Coming up on the programme, our reporter Samira Hussain has been to the Kumbh Mela, a huge Hindu festival. It really is huge, on the banks of the Ganges in northern India.
It's 5:15 in the morning. It's still very dark out, but you can hear chanting echoing everywhere. Many are making their way to the Ganges for morning prayers and to take a spiritual dip in water.
It is an amazing spectacle, and Samira will be bringing it to us in about 25 minutes. Headline this hour, China has reported its biggest ever trade surplus days before the inauguration of Donald Trump, who has promised to impose tariffs on Chinese goods. This is NewsHour. It's live from the BBC World Service with me, Tim Franks. It is nighttime right about now in and around Los Angeles. And it's then that you see the danger most vividly. Looking up into the skies, you can see the eddies and flurries of embers scudding on the strong winds, which is why, although firefighters say they are making some progress in controlling the blazes that have so far killed 24 and levelled thousands of properties, there is still real concern that the strong seasonal winds mean the danger is far from over. The Pasadena fire chief, Chad Augustin, told the BBC The next few days will be critical.
We got a fork in the road. Once we get past Wednesday night, I'm going to be saying, whew, we made it, and this fire is just about under control, and then we're going to spend the next couple weeks just mopping up hot spots and embers, or this fire is going to take off on Tuesday or Wednesday with these increased wind conditions. So obviously, we have the resources here. I'm going to say that we're going to keep gaining containment on this fire, but it is definitely going to be an all hands on deck these next few days.
The BBC's Peter Bowes is up very late for us on the West Coast. Peter, thank you for joining us. You've been across these fires from the get-go. What's your sense of how the battle is going?
Well, the next 2 days, 3 days are indeed going to be critical. I think for better or worse, things are going to change. And of course, we hope for better, but the predictions in terms of the winds are quite ominous, that they will really kick up again. Not quite as bad as the almost hurricane force winds that we had last week, but the gusts are forecast to reach up to 112 kilometres per hour is the latest that I've seen. And that is strong. And that is going to potentially hamper the firefighters who are still working on those three blazes, the two big ones that are still largely burning out of control. And just to give you an idea of how things change quickly, it is in fact now 20 past six in the morning. I've been up since about 3:30. At 4 a.m. I received a notification on my phone that there was a new vegetation fire just a few miles away. And I've been watching the progress of that over the last couple of hours, and they've made good progress. It's positive news that they really jumped on that particular fire quickly, and it seems to be almost fully extinguished. And that's, of course, what they hope for, to prevent these fires spreading in the dramatic and destructive way that the others have spread over the last few days.
And I guess, you know, it's a compounding effect that the more the fires are controlled, then the more it's possible to deploy a greater number of firefighters to those fires that are still going. But in terms of the other resources, in terms of the sort of planes that can dump fire retardant, in terms of the water, are you getting a sense that the authorities are getting a handle on that as well?
I am getting that impression. There have been, certainly over the last few days, a lot of resources coming in from out of state, neighbouring states, Arizona, Washington, Oregon. We have in California now assistance in terms of firefighters and equipment and indeed soldiers from overseas. So Mexico, Canada providing a lot of resources as well. And so I don't think that aspect of it is a particular problem at the moment. It is managing those assets. And we're told that because of this critical situation over the next couple of days, they're redeploying some of the firefighters to different areas. The winds are likely to hit certain parts of Los Angeles to the north and to the west harder than other areas. And there's a science involved in this in terms of tackling these fires, but it's certainly a critical moment.
Just briefly, Peter, we're going to be looking at the politics of this in a bit more detail later in the programme, but how much anger is there in California about the way in which the authorities have handled this?
There is some anger, and I would say, and I qualify that by saying that a lot of people understand the unprecedented nature of this and the really intense pressures that there've been on firefighters and the authorities to deal with this situation. But there is anger. We've heard a lot about the fire hydrants running out of water in the early hours of this crisis. The governor has called for an investigation into that. And yes, other people are angered more generally about what they see as a lack of preparation for a situation as grave as this.
Peter Bowes in Los Angeles, thanks so much for joining us. Few places in the world feel more remote than the snow-covered peaks of Greenland. The world's largest island that sits beneath the North Pole is home to fewer than 60,000 people. But now it finds itself at the centre of a geopolitical storm, as Donald Trump says he wants to buy the independent territory, currently part of Denmark, for what he calls economic security. So what do the Greenlanders themselves want? Our correspondent Fergal Keane has been to visit.
It is one of the world's last wild frontiers, glimpsed in the short winter sunlight. We're travelling into a place of pristine beauty that's suddenly been overtaken by diplomatic crisis.
This place is so remote that it's hard to imagine it as the front line of a major geopolitical row. But up and down this fjord in isolated settlements and across the island of Greenland, they're talking about Trump.
Those who live here know the strain of harsh weather and the demands of survival. But again and again I would hear, this is their land.
Welcome to farm.
Welcome to Son. This wonderful place.
Yes.
And Guttimerik Hansen and his family hunt and raise sheep for a living. What do you feel about Trump?
What the stupid human in the world like a Trump. We need to work together with US, not Trump.
There's worry here. An Inuit culture that struggled against Danish colonialism doesn't want any new power taking over. Kalirak Ringsted is a village pastor. This isn't an argument about owning Greenland, he says. It's about a people's culture and history.
In our opinion, it's wild and weird to hear him speak of our country as something that can just be bought. We don't view it as a purchasable land. We have been here for a long time. We are used to our ways of living.
In the capital, Nuuk, there's a feeling that the Trump intervention has brought world attention to Greenland's campaign for independence. And there's pragmatism, a desire for strong links and financial help from America and Denmark.
Donald Trump is a politician. He's a hard businessman, and we know his rhetoric, and that rhetoric is something we have gotten used to since 2019. But what is necessary here is that Greenland, as a sovereign state, should negotiate directly with the United States and not Denmark.
The Eskimo are very primitive, and the Danish government is doing its best to keep civilization from spoiling them.
To understand what Greenlanders feel about the colonial past, it's important to know about racism and abuses.
Some home when a ship comes in.
Hedvig Friedrichsen was only 14 when Danish officials fitted her with a contraceptive coil without her permission in the 1970s. She's one of over 100 women suing Denmark for its efforts to limit Greenland's population.
It was a very awful experience. I was still a child. It was just awful. I think the Danish people looked down on us, especially back then.
What do you need Denmark to do?
I want them to apologise.
However mighty, those wanting to control this land must reckon with an enduring struggle for dignity and self-determination.
Fergal Keane reporting from Greenland. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Welcome back to NewsHour. The man behind some of the most distinctive and controversial advertising campaigns of recent years, the Italian fashion photographer Oliviero Toscani, has died at the age of 82. He reached the peak of his fame in the 1990s with his work for the clothing brand Benetton. Among his most eye-catching images were those showing a terribly emaciated anorexic model, he said to decry the fashion industry's demand for painfully thin women, and a man in the death throes from AIDS at a time when the disease was still heavily stigmatised. Carrie Jacobs was the founding editor, along with Oliviero Toscani, of a magazine Benetton produced back in the early 90s to go alongside its campaigns.
When we met him, of course, he was famous for the Benetton ads that were really sweet ads, right? They featured these multi-culti teenagers smiling and wearing sweaters, and we sort of made fun of them. But he seemed to have a deeper agenda. And one day I was called into Tibor Kalman's office, and they had a pile of photographs, Tibor and Toscani. And they said, look through these photographs and tell us which ones you think are the most shocking. And so I was sort of sorting them into two piles, like horrific and not horrific. And the ones that were in the horrific pile, like one of, it was like a mafia hit car bomb, and the one of the man dying of AIDS, those are the ones that became the ads. So that's my memory of that campaign.
And what discussion was there around turning these incredibly striking and to many people outrageous images into advertising?
I think that Toscani wanted to change what advertising was. He was known for doing these ads that were just saccharine sweet. And I think that he thought that he could break through in a way that perhaps a news photo on a news show couldn't, that he could reach people with these images through advertising that they otherwise wouldn't notice. But he was right. I mean, those images were around. They were images that had been shot by news photographers, and maybe people had looked at them, but not the way they did when they were run as ads.
Obviously, there are two arguments here, but one is he was exploiting terrible things, essentially for commercial purposes. And the other is to say, well, actually, no, he was telling people, you need to have your eyes opened.
I think that if anything, he was exploiting Benetton's money to do things that he thought were important. I didn't always agree. I was kind of horrified when I realized that the ads that I put in the "this is too grotesque" pile were the ones that wound up in the ads. But I think that he had the trust and the assets for a long time of Luciano Benetton and was able to do these projects.
Carrie Jacobs on the legacy of Oliviero Toscani. You're with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London with me, Tim Franks. The president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, has shared some striking images on his social media feed within the last day. There are two heavily bandaged men with East Asian faces who are answering questions put to them in Korean. They are, he says, two soldiers from North Korea whom the Ukrainian military have captured and whom President Zelensky says he's willing to return to Pyongyang in exchange for Ukrainian POWs held in Russia. Meanwhile, the South Korean intelligence services have been briefing new figures on casualties sustained by North Korean soldiers in their fight alongside Russian troops against Ukraine. Among the select members of the South Korean parliament who have been directly briefed by the security services is Park Sun-won, member of the National Assembly from the main opposition Democratic Party.
The South Korean intelligence service says that Russia is gaining upper hand on all fronts. However, North Korean troops in the region are not doing well. North Koreans are spread all across the battlefields in the Kursk region and taking heavy casualties. NIS, National Intelligence Service, estimated that about 300 North Koreans are dead and more than 2,700 are wounded so far. So if the war goes on and on, North Korea may deploy some additional soldiers there in the future.
Oh, that's interesting. So there's a sense of North Korea doubling down. I mean, because 3,000 casualties, I mean, most of them wounded, yeah, but some of them dead, out of a deployment of about 10,000. That's a high rate of casualties.
Yes, almost 30%.
Yeah, and you might imagine that the North Korean authorities would think, well, we can't really afford to lose men at that rate. But your own intelligence services are saying they may well deploy more forces.
Yeah, North Korea has a great number of special forces, around 100,000 or more at least. Therefore, they have some room to deploy a bit more numbers to there. However, if President Putin and President Trump will reach some agreement about ceasefire, then the story could be different.
And is it useful intelligence as well for South Korea in terms of trying to understand the rules of engagement, how North Korean troops are deployed, the sort of way in which they're expected to fight?
Even if it was well known that the North Korean special forces are well trained and relatively have high morale in the battlefield. However, according to the National Intelligence's assessment, that currently the North Koreans are totally unprepared for the modern battlefield. For example, they are shooting at Ukraine drones from great distances, which is meaningless other than exposing themselves. So they are now making frontal charges against Ukraine defenses across the open field without any effective fire support from Russian side, therefore suffering heavy casualties so far.
Are you getting any intelligence on how this deployment of North Korean troops alongside Russian troops is being viewed inside North Korea?
NIS also gathered some bits of intelligence on how it's being perceived in North Korea, despite North Korea regime's efforts to hide the reality in Russia. However, words and rumors are smuggling, spreading among the North Korean public that their troops are fighting in Ukraine. So families of those deployed are expressing, of course, very naturally their anxiety and concerns, and others, without any direct link to the soldiers, are showing expectations about getting economic aids from Russia and improved living conditions. So there are indications that North Korean regimes is providing material support to families of the deployed soldiers.
Park Sun-won, South Korean MP from the main opposition Democratic Party. Well, let's get the views now of one of our regular experts on the war in Ukraine, Shashank Joshi. He's the Economist's defense editor. What does he make of these briefings by the South Korean intelligence agencies?
I think, first of all, you have to keep in mind the tactics that are being used on the front line. These North Korean forces are fighting alongside Russian forces. They're using, as most of your listeners will know by now, very crude meat grinder tactics, sending assault units forward in the face of heavy Ukrainian fire, seeking to overwhelm Ukrainian positions. And on top of that, the North Koreans are not au fait with the latest on the battlefield. The ubiquity of drones, for instance, that are very familiar to the Russians, much less familiar to the North Koreans. So when you take all that into account, there's no surprise that there are high casualties. But I think the other interesting question is that these are supposed to be North Korean specialist units. These are special forces. And in that context, clearly, they haven't performed perhaps as more effectively as people thought they might.
I guess one of the other things that has come out of this briefing, at least according to this South Korean MP we've spoken to, is that North Korea feels that it is a rate of attrition that they can afford, because he was suggesting that North Korea is getting prepared to send more troops.
Well, these are special forces, but they're not special forces in the sense of the British SAS or the American Navy SEALs. They're a much bigger core of troops. Some of them, you might describe them as specialized light infantry rather than incredibly elite forces, very small in number. And even a few months ago, I was talking to Ukrainians who were saying, we're very concerned. We may wake up one day in the spring or the summer and realize that there are actually 100,000 North Koreans who have turned up, you know, that this could become a pipeline of forces rather than just a one-off deployment. And that fear of a continued replenishment of forces was exactly one of the things that drove Joe Biden to authorize the use of ATACMS missiles on Russian soil against North Korea and in Kursk province, because he wanted to show the North Koreans that they would suffer such heavy casualties it wouldn't be worth replacing.
Just in terms of this figure of a roughly 30% attrition for the North Korean troops, is it possible to say how much credibility South Korean intelligence has on this sort of information?
Well, South Korean intelligence does tend to be very good on North Korea for obvious reasons. And indeed, along with Ukrainian intelligence, it was the very first to identify the dispatch of North Korean forces to Russia at a time when Western intelligence services were clearly much more hesitant to confirm that information, either because they didn't know or because they weren't sure. So I think South Korea's intelligence service deserves some credit for that. Having said that, I'll offer two caveats. One of them is that casualty estimates are, you know, really an art, not a science. You're guessing lots of the time. time, or you're relying on intercepted communications that may or may not be credible. And the second important thing here is that it is worth noting South Korea is in a period of political turmoil. The National Intelligence Service is a professional intelligence service, but it is also led by figures with strong political interests. They have a strong interest in sending messages to European states, in building support against North Korea. So again, what they say probably has to be corroborated, I think, against other agencies and other sources looking at the same issue.
And just to pull out the focus, I guess it is worth just reminding ourselves about the progress of the war. Is it right still to say that Russia is making slow but apparently inexorable progress on that Eastern Front?
Well, towards the latter sort of few months of the last year, the end of 2024, Russian gains accelerated. And if you look at October-November time, they took more territory in that period than at any time since the first rushed phases of the war in 2022. So it wasn't even particularly slow. And the bigger problem was Ukraine was taking very heavy casualties in holding the line back. That hasn't entirely stopped. We're still seeing Ukrainians take very heavy casualties. Russia has pushed further into this very important town of Pokrovsk in eastern Ukraine on the central part of the front. And I think one of the things the Trump administration, when it takes office in a week, will grapple with is how do you persuade the Russians to negotiate, to talk over a settlement when they feel they are still making gains and still have the upper hand.
And that was Shashank Joshi, The Economist's defense editor. One of the world's largest religious festivals is underway in India, the Kumbh Mela, which happens every 12 years. Over the next 45 days, officials are expecting 400 million Hindus, 400 million, extraordinary, to make their way to where the three rivers, the Ganges, the Yamuna and the mythical Saraswati meet. Devotees believe their sins will be washed away if they bathe in the waters. Our South Asia correspondent Samira Hussain reports from the Mela in Prayagraj in Uttar Pradesh in northern India.
It's 5:15 in the morning. It's still very dark out, but you can hear chanting echoing everywhere. Many are making their way to the Ganges for morning prayers and to take a spiritual dip in water. I'm walking with Vinod Singh and his wife, Sushila. There are more than 100 people that are bathing at this particular spot along the Ganges River, and it's quite a lovely scene despite the morning cold. People are chatting, some start chanting. Many have come with families. I see a young boy, can't be more than 12 years old, who's also taking a dip. There's a real community atmosphere. People are bathing here because this is where the Ganges River meets the Yamuna and the mythical river Saraswati, which is mentioned in religious texts. And Hindus believe that bathing in these waters right now will wash away their sins. आंटी आपने अभी नहा के आए हैं आपको कैसे लगा
बहुत अच्छा लगा है हमें और नहा के आई हमको ठंड नहीं लग रही
She just said that she has gone into the water and she feels really good that walking here she was feeling quite cold but when she went into the river she didn't feel cold anymore Now there are religious ceremonies happening everywhere here The fairgrounds of this Maha Kumbh Mela are enormous, more than 15 square miles. That's about 4,000 football pitches. There are thousands of cloth tents dotting the expanse of fairgrounds, and I've come to the tents where Vinod Singh and his wife will be staying for the next month. So I'm looking inside of his tent. It's quite cozy in here. You see a bed area. He basically has a bunch of blankets and pillows. And then on my left, I can see he's got a stove and some fresh water. It's actually quite lovely in here. Faith is what brings so many people here.
but it's the sense of community that makes people want to stay.
And that was Samira Hussain reporting from Uttar Pradesh in northern India on the start of the Kumbh Mela. More about it with some wonderful photos on our website, bbc.com/news. There's a piece by one of our other colleagues in India, Geeta Pandey. This is NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC in London with me, Tim Franks. And we're going to head back to the fires in Los Angeles now, because as the flames continue to roar, so the politics of all this are heating up, with Donald Trump and his ally, Elon Musk, excoriating the city and statewide leadership in California. Incompetent, said Mr. Trump, of the Democratic politicians in charge. They just can't put out the fires. What's wrong with them? To which those same politicians, chief among them the governor of California, Gavin Newsom, have claimed that such attacks are ill-timed in the midst of a disaster and based on misinformation. Calvin Dark is a US political commentator and joins us now. Calvin, what do you make of the fact that there is such a heated row between Donald Trump and Gavin Newsom, and also the mayor of LA?
Hi, yes, good to be here. It's clear that the argument between the president-elect and Governor Newsom has been brewing for a long time. You know, there's the family angle, because Gavin Newsom's ex-wife is the ex-fiancée of Donald Trump's son. That's one separate soap opera. But politically, we know that Gavin Newsom will be one of the, possibly the most important Democratic candidate for the presidency in 2028. And so he has been a target for Republicans, and particularly Donald Trump. We also know that the issue of aid in the United States has become extremely politicized. And one of the consequences of that is people hear the news based on which team it's coming from. We need an actual discussion around preparedness. Was California prepared as they should have been? Was their focus too much on climate change? But because Democrats won't question it because it's political, and Republicans won't give credit where credit is due because it's a Democratic state, we're kind of in this politicized era with no real solutions.
And could it get to the point where Donald Trump, when he goes into the White House in a week's time, could he actually decide that he's going to withhold federal aid to California?
I think he's going to threaten it. I think in the end of the day, he's not going to do it, because we know the economy of California is bigger than many countries around this world. Also, even though California is heavily Democratic, it's heavily Republican as well. Donald Trump has properties there. So he will politicize the issue. There's even talk about there's a debt ceiling and economic tax issue that we deal with in the United States. He's actually proposing to tie that to aid for California. In the end, California will get the aid that it needs, but there may be a political fight to kind of show, put Gavin Newsom on the national stage, since he's going to be a Democratic candidate, most likely.
Right. And I mean, I guess also there's going to be big questions, just briefly, about, you know, who's going to pay for the cleanup, and you know, who's going to pay for insurance in the future?
Yes, it's a very important question, and you're going to see a lot of opposition, particularly from Republicans, given the state of the California economy being so big. There's going to be the argument that why should poor states chip in to save them this time? So that's going to be a political fight as well.
Calvin, great to have you on the program. Thank you very much for joining us. Now, for most people in Britain, today is the 13th of January, indeed for a lot of people around the world. But on the UK's most remote inhabited island, today is also being celebrated as New Year's Day. Fula has about 35 or so inhabitants. The island's official website is hazy about the exact number. What we do know is that it lies far off the north coast of Scotland. And among its quirks, back in 1752, it didn't follow the rest of the United Kingdom in adopting the newfangled Gregorian calendar that pretty much all of us around the world now do. They've stuck, for the big ticket items, such as New Year's Day, with the old Julian calendar. 27-year-old Robert Smith lives on Fula, and I guess the place to start is Happy New Year.
Yeah, thanks. Happy New Year.
At least on my studio clock, at the Monday the 13th of January. But it's not, as far as you're concerned. What does it feel like celebrating? I guess you probably celebrate New Year twice, don't you?
Yeah, I personally celebrate on the 25th and the 1st with my girlfriend and her family on mainland Shetland, and then I returned to Fula and celebrate the 6th and the 13th was my fuller family.
Right. And the 25th of December, the 6th of January being when you celebrate Christmas, in other words.
So, yeah, that's right.
So you get twice the fun. Did you have a party overnight, or are the big celebrations later on today?
Usually it would be later on today. People will go around visiting with a bottle of whiskey or something like that and kind of catching up with each other. And then towards the end of the day, we'll all gather at someone's house and have a party, play a lot of music. And usually that goes on into the early hours of the morning, maybe 7 a.m. or 9 a.m.
Oh, my goodness me. Gosh, you're going to have sore heads tomorrow. Do you know why Fuller decided to stick to the old Julian calendar?
It was several hundred years ago. The church adjusted the calendar to compensate for something to do with leap years. So people were terrified back then at the thought of losing 12 days of their life. So a lot of the country, Great Britain, opposed it and refused to follow the new calendar. I suppose places like Shetland and Fuller just were slower to catch up.
It's terrific to be able to have an excuse to speak to you today, because I'm not sure, despite the fact that I've spoken to people all around the world, I'm not sure I've ever spoken to anybody from Fuller. Mm-hmm. And given also that I've never visited, just give me a sense of what life is like. I mean, you, for example, presumably, because there are relatively few people on the island, presumably somebody like you have to do a bunch of jobs. Tell me what it is that you do.
I do a lot of things. Mainly I work as ferry crew on the local ferry, taking in people's groceries and fuel and coal and building materials, things like that. I work at the water treatment plant where we process water from a spring on the island. I work at the electricity scheme, so we generate our own electricity on the island from renewables and from diesel generators. I also work with Full Heritage, giving guided tours and doing nature studies as well.
And the island itself, I mean, it's got, am I right in saying it's about 30-odd people live there? I mean, does it feel that it's an island with a future?
Yeah, very much so. I would say we have a good amount of young people. There's 5 children at local school and a lot of young people who have gone to high school, finished high school and have decided to come back to the isle. So that's always encouraging. And our electricity scheme, trying to get towards net zero, then we're keeping up with the times, kind of looking towards the future with that as well.
We've been broadcasting a long time here on NewsHour, but I think that is genuinely a first to hear from the Scottish island of Fuller, celebrating New Year today, and you were listening to Robert Smith. That's it from this edition of the programme. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for your company.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there.
I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me,
was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.